Hello, 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 and welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. We are joined today by a guest that I think is going to be very, very interesting to talk to. I'm really stoked. Guys, we have Amanda Olson, DPT, Doctor of Physical Therapy, and we're going to be talking all about pelvic floor. Brace yourselves. And of course, I am joined by the always lovely Amy Hollenkamp, R to the D.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome, welcome. So, Amanda, I am so pumped to get to talk to you. I revealed before we hopped on the actual recording, I said, I've been creeping on you on Instagram for a while. First off, Amanda, will you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, about your practice, what you do, and then also, what is your Instagram handle again? Can you remind people
it
of that?
Yes, it is at Intimate Rose. Yep. Yes. So I am by background a physical therapist specializing in pelvic health. So clinically speaking, I help people of all genders and ages and backgrounds that are experiencing anything from urinary incontinence to constipation and bowel issues to pelvic pain. So essentially anything that can go wrong from the mid-level of the chest down to the hip level is a domain that I have specific expertise over. And then additionally, I have a company, Intimate Rose, where I create pelvic health devices that help empower people to be independent in management of their pelvic health issues. And I do a lot of teaching and talking and all kinds of other fun stuff.
Yeah, and I am deeply curious about these tools too, because I've seen, again, I've been creeping on you on Instagram. So I've seen the tools pop up and I don't know the first thing about them necessarily, but I like that you emphasize helping people like be independent with their care and not necessarily have, I assume not necessarily needing to go see a pelvic floor PT for appointments indefinitely forever. Like at some point they can kind of gain some control or some wisdom into and insight to the point where they can manage it more so at home, right?
You got it. Absolutely. Our primary goal in physical therapy is we want to determine what the patient's individual goals are. And then we want to help them reach those. Depending on what the goals are and the current health status is, it could be a few weeks to, you know, some of the people with pain and other longer standing chronic type issues could be more like a year. But ultimately, our goal is to get them independent, living their life, not having to attend appointments, and with a means of self-management or completely overcoming the issues altogether.
Absolutely. And I think this is probably a root cause for a fair number of people with IBS, if I had to wager. I know you actually said mid-chest level, so I'm kind of curious. You went up much higher than I thought you would when you gave us kind of the chunk of the body that you have expertise in. Are you kind of wrangling in the respiratory diaphragm? Is that the idea there, that up basically up 100%. To the respiratory diaphragm? Okay.
Yeah, 100%. I have colleagues too that would even venture to say that all the way up to the glottis, because swallowing mechanics and breath holding through the throat can also impact the pelvic floor. And the reason that is because, you know, going back to the diaphragm and the pelvic floor work together in harmony when they're functioning properly, like a piston. So when we inhale through the respiratory diaphragm, the pelvic floor drops and relaxes. And when we exhale, it naturally lifts. But any disruption in that piston-like mechanic in the trunk can really result in a lot of issues in the pelvic floor, usually, and sometimes within the rib cage itself. But those issues could include surgery, it could include trauma, it could include injuries to the back and to the spine. So there's a lot of different root causes or drivers that can impact that. But we need to manage that whole trunk mechanics to get people to where they need to be.
That makes sense. And it's kind of like, you know, the bottom of the bowl versus the lid, I guess, and they're going up and down together in an ideal world. I can think of something else that would throw that off potentially, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but babies? Like, the baby would be squishing everything right in the middle of that, right? So
100%.
People will think of C-sections and the scar tissue and the adhesions as a root cause for SIBO, for example, or IBS, but not necessarily the fact that just carrying a baby in your abdomen is like shoving all your organs around and probably putting a lot of pressure on the diaphragm and the pelvic floor, right?
Absolutely. If they're causing compression there, they can cause compression to the nerves and to the vasculature of the organs and the muscles themselves. And depending on how that baby's sitting and if they're really pinching down hard on some of those structures, it can take several months to a year to have those tissues fully heal and recalibrate again.
Cool. Babies can be kind of rude, can't they?
So selfish.
I know. You're here first, folks.
I know. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Nikki.
No,
I was going to say, too, like, I think something you mentioned, too, that we can touch on a little bit later as well, but I think when I think of pelvic floor, typically I think more of, like, women, but I think you said, you know, you work with all individuals, so I'm sure there's men that need pelvic floor as well, and I couldn't imagine that that's probably very, like, almost you're in an awareness building stage as a PT of what does a man look like that needs pelvic floor type therapy compared to a woman. But I found that really interesting when you were describing it, because I'd imagine that there's a lot of men that have pelvic floor issues too and just don't know it, and it's not really something that's, I think pelvic floor stuff for women still like breaking ground in a lot of different ways, and then thinking about it from a man standpoint, it's again, I've never seen a man doing pelvic floor therapy, but I'm sure they can have some of the same issues, maybe different in some ways, but I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people are unaware that men even have a pelvic floor, including men themselves, until right. There's an issue. And so you are absolutely right. We're building awareness within the general population as to this is available as a means of treatment. And then also we're building awareness in our providers and in our patient population. So for men, for example, they can have injury to the pelvic floor with a slip or a fall. They can have surgeries to the pelvis and to the pelvic region for appendix issues or intestinal issues. They can have cancer, so prostate cancer, colon cancer, anal cancer, those types of things result in injury and trauma to the pelvic floor. So for example, after prostate cancer, generally what happens is they undergo prostatectomy. The prostate is removed. It's highly disruptive to the pelvic bowl, to the intestines, which back up to it, and then to the pelvic floor itself. So we are doing extensive rehabilitation for them.
So cool.
It almost makes me wonder, too, if, like, prostate issues outside of cancer could contribute. Because if you think, if the tissues are right there next to each other, right, like the prostate and the pelvic floor, inflammation in one tissue could kind of, for lack of a better term, trickle over to the neighboring tissue and inflame the other tissue, potentially, right?
You got it. It can cause compression. So compression itself can be painful. So it can be driving pain. It can be driving irritability in the bowel. It can also inhibit pelvic floor muscle function. You know, we know that pain can inhibit our ability to fully utilize our muscles in a normal way. And so all of that can impact their continence status, their pain levels, their ability to urinate properly. It's all very frustrating for them and very alarming, you know, especially because a lot of these issues can happen later in life. Not always, but, you know, they've gone their whole life with this brain map of what their body is. And now all of a sudden they're having issues with the daily life function. And, you know, they're having to learn about anatomy that was never a concern for them.
Yeah. I feel like that's a lot of our patient populations. Like, once you start on a healing journey, you have to learn all these things that you never thought you would have to learn. Yeah. You know, like, people who are accountants probably never thought that they would need to learn what SIBO is and what Candida is and, like, what leaky gut means, but they do very frequently.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm curious, in particular, you know, one of the main things on my mind inviting you on the podcast was how this would relate to constipation. But I know we were talking about this before the recording, that this pelvic floor dysfunction can also impact things like diarrhea and bloating and other sort of gut issues. But could we start with constipation first? And then maybe we'll kind of tackle this a little bit more individually. And we'll talk about how these symptoms come about, like what role the pelvic floor plays, and then what sort of therapies you found helpful. And is there such a thing? I know that you can have a hypertonic pelvic floor, right? The muscles can be too tight. Can you have the muscles be too loose and like not hypotonic? Is that a thing as well? Before we get into constipation, can you just give us a broad overview first before I get ahead of myself?
Absolutely. So essentially all of what you just said is spot on. So I've got my model here for those that are watching on YouTube.
If you're not on YouTube, you're missing out.
Yeah, jump onto the visual part because it's super fun. So here's the pelvic model. This is the front of the pelvis. Here's the back, and you'd have your yep. spine coming up here. I just want to remind everyone that the hip joints are very close related. So we're often assessing that very closely. But inside the pelvic bowl, this is a female model. You'll see the bowel all the way in the back here, and then the yep. uterus and vagina in the middle, and the bladder in front. And what you'll yep. notice is that all of these are three tenants in a very tight apartment. And they basically just share fascial walls. So you can appreciate why an issue with one can certainly affect the other neighboring yeah. organs. And so when you're talking about overactivity or hypertonicity of the pelvic floor or versus underactivity, both of those are a thing. So the pelvic floor muscles, everything that you see in red here, have multiple layers. Here's yeah. the deep layer. And they can be too tight, just like your hamstrings can be too tight. They can be too weak or too loose, just like anywhere else in the body. So the muscle function doesn't change. It just changes because it's in a sensitive area, and now it's starting to affect organ function like bowel and bladder. Hypertonicity, or where the muscles are too tight, we commonly see this in people that have pelvic pain, constipation, difficulty using a tampon, difficulty having penetrative sex. All of those happen because the pelvic floor muscles are clenching around the yeah. urethra and the vagina and the rectum here. On the other side of that, if the pelvic floor muscles are too weak, they're not providing good support to those organs. So we can see things like urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse, where it feels like the organs are falling out of the vagina. And in some cases, not to scare people, but they actually are, because yeah. we've got less support down here and those organs are dropping down. So essentially, those can be thought of as two different diagnostic umbrellas. But oftentimes we do see some overlap. It is possible for the muscles to be too tight. Yeah, but also that they're not very strong. They're held in a short position, but they're not necessarily very strong and they're not very flexible. So then when we think about constipation, there can be a lot of different drivers for that. If the intestines themselves don't have good transit, if they're not producing their nice little waves to process food and things, then we are certainly interested in their nutrition. We're interested in their neurologic function, and we would want to be yeah. including gastroenterologists and ensuring that there's nothing more serious at hand. Yeah. If all of that is functioning as it should be for all intents and purposes, then we look at outlet dysfunction or functional constipation, where fecal material, the poo, is being moved around, but the person is having great difficulty evacuating because either one, these pelvic floor muscles are too tight, or two, they don't have good coordination. So that's kind of a funny concept for a lot of people, is that you need to have coordination very similar to driving a stiff shift. We need things to be dropping and relaxing on command from the brain in order to get those out. So for people that are experiencing constipation, they may be accidentally, not knowing it, clenching around here instead of relaxing and dropping. Sometimes that can be a habit that's trained if they were, when they were small, they had a painful bowel movement. You know, perhaps they were dehydrated and they had just one of those episodes where it was kind of a fluke thing, but it was a painful experience. And that can change and further create the cyclic pattern of clenching to prevent that pain, which then makes it very hard to have a bowel movement, trying to push out a mass through a very small opening, yeah. which is in turn a painful experience. So it can become very cyclic and often yeah. starting very early in life. Sometimes we see people that were raised in households where potty training was really stressful, or there was like a lot of pressure surrounding that. Maybe they experienced accidents and they were punished, and so they developed some clenching habits because of that. Mm-hmm. Some people, none of that happened. Life was very forgiving and gracious and everything was fine, but they don't have good coordination of these muscles. Sometimes it's because they have some sensory integration issues. And sometimes it's just because of after childbirth or other injuries, there's been some nerve changes there. Having scar tissue in the abdomen from C-section or appendectomy or intestinal procedures can also create adhesions around that to where the gut isn't getting good mobility, and that can create some transit issues that are still musculoskeletal in nature. But in pelvic physical therapy, we do a lot of manual therapy. It's very, very gentle. So the manual therapy in pelvic health is not a no pain, no gain situation, but we are very gentle with that. We do a lot of gentle techniques and likewise with the pelvic floor. So sometimes if they've been clenching for a long time, they have tender points, trigger points that are embedded just the same way you would get in your neck or your back, and you push on it and it's very, very painful. Those can happen in the pelvic floor. And so we do gentle release maneuvers there to help relieve that so that the muscles have that good flexibility. And then we train you how to relax and drop to allow for easy evacuation of those bowels. So that's constipation in a nutshell.
And I'm curious, you know, I think the idea of like too tight or too loosey-goosey makes sense. But the coordination I'm really curious about, like how do you teach these muscles how to be better coordinated? Because like, you know, if you're doing sub movement, like you're learning biceps for bicep curls for the first time, the first one you ever do might look goofy AF. But then you kind of, you learn how to do it with lighter weights. Maybe you work with a trainer. You can see the muscle contract. With the pelvic floor, they're in this bony cage and they're in a very difficult to access location. So I'm curious what that would look like teaching the muscles to be more coordinated and work together better.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do we use visual cues and verbal cues when you really can't see it? Just, you know, like easy peasy looking at your elbow, watching it in a mirror, being able to put your finger on it. So in pelvic physical therapy, there's a number of different tools that we have. And every person is unique. So we all learn different ways. Some of us are very visual learners. Some of us are tactile or more kinesthetic. We learn by doing. And some of us hear instructions and then we're able to put it to good use and use that. So in a formal physical therapy setting, you know, your physical therapist is working to understand how you learn best. And that's why we have all these different things available. So one of the tools is visual feedback, either by way of biofeedback or real-time ultrasound. I'm a big fan of real-time ultrasound. I love being able to image it and the person can actually see it. It's so amazing. I think regardless of what learning style you are, getting a good clear image of your bladder and seeing your pelvic floor in this bright light white and watching yourself do it right for the first time ever is like the most amazing, mind-blowing experience for patients ever. I've really come to love that. It's a very expensive tool. So a lot of small private practices don't have it, but you could see it in some larger health settings. So that's to say is we use those instruments to provide that visual cueing. So real-time ultrasound is the same you would use to see a baby or to make sure your kidneys are functioning properly. The transducer goes in your abdomen and you can see all your organs. You can see your pelvic floor. You can see it lift and drop. So when we're teaching people for constipation specifically, if these are the pelvic floor muscles here, we're giving cues. So examples of cues might include, they sound silly. So we have a bunch of different cues to see what lands best on the person in front of us. But some cues include, okay, I want you to imagine that you are releasing your pelvic floor and you're going to gently blow a bubble like you would with bubble gum. Mm. So you could imagine that drop and bulge. We need that to happen to open around the rectum, around the anus here. Gentle relaxation and dropping and opening to allow that to happen. So that's one cue. Another cue is to imagine that the pelvic floor around the rectum or around the vagina is a rose and it's in a bud currently, but I want you to make that rose bloom down and out. So those are examples of how we give auditory cues to elicit a response, and then we can monitor it visually. If you don't have fancy tools or if you're seeing a pelvic physical therapist that don't have those, do not fret. They're still amazing pelvic physical therapists that don't have those, that you can be using one hand broad, just down where you sit, and you can be feeling it drop down. Mm-hmm. You can use a mirror and you can be practicing at home on yourself, just the same kind of mirror that you would use to make sure your hair is where it goes. And you can watch. And when you drop, it's very, very slight, but you can see it. Uh-huh. And you can also see if you did it wrong, because a lot of people are accidentally clenching up, especially in the early stages. So then you can use that as a visual tool as well. So those are a couple of examples. The other thing we do is educate people about good toileting posture. And so that way, when they are at home, they can have more success. And that would include using a device like a squatty potty or even some yoga bricks. And the goal there is to get the knees above the pelvis and to get the knees nice and wide to open up the muscles. So it puts the muscles naturally in a more open position by doing that, having the knees up elevated above the pelvis and have them nice and wide. And then the cues we use when we're initially teaching someone is to expand the abdomen a bit. So almost like make your belly like a basketball, and then to keep it extended and gently tense it. So if you do that right now, if you expand your abdomen, make it big, make a basketball belly, and then gently tense it, do you feel a gentle drop happen down into the pelvic floor?
Yeah.
And we still want to be breathing. We don't ever want to hold the breath, but you can drop and breathe and relax to have a better opening around there. Hmm. And that's one quick and easy way to get people feeling a little bit more successful with their toileting while we're working on addressing the coordination and the pelvic floor muscle flexibility.
That's really cool. And I've never actually heard of the real-time ultrasound being used for pelvic floor PT. I've heard about using biofeedback, but I hadn't heard about using ultrasound in that way. So that's really freaking cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. And biofeedback still, you know, biofeedback's been around a long time. There's lots of different visual stimuli there. Sometimes it's a line and the therapist will say, I want you to make the line go up. And I want you to make the line go down, and different pelvic floor muscle function will make a visual line go up or down. Or there are some with the actual rose, and it's a pretty image of a rose. And then the sensors go on your pelvic floor. So they're hooked up to your body and then to the computer, and then they'll say drop and relax, and you get to see a nice rose bloom down and out. It's very fun. And then for children, we see children too. There's fun little like dolphin games where it's make the dolphin jump. Okay, now make the dolphin go underwater. Yeah. Those kinds of things.
Cool. I think too, I was curious, like, I'd imagine you work a lot with like moms after childbirth and that sort of stuff. I was curious though too, like, would you suggest, like, I almost think doing pelvic exercises prior to birth would be really beneficial, but I never really hear as much about that. Is that something that's done, or?
It certainly can. It would be indicated for someone that was experiencing underactivity of the pelvic floor muscles to begin with. You can generally do them too in the first trimester. What we don't want to be doing, what can happen in the second and third trimesters is doing those activations, doing those Kegels can sometimes kick up a little bit of a uterine contraction response and can put someone into either Braxton Hicks or true uterine contractions. And we don't want that happening until...
No way.
Till evacuation day.
Right.
until the birthday. And so when we think about prehab or pre-rehabilitation, like you're mentioning, certainly it can be worthwhile to go and do a consult with a pelvic PT to check on the current status of the pelvic floor and to teach proper pelvic floor muscle activation exercises so that after birth, you're ready to go and ready to do them. Because certainly birth, whether by pregnancy and birth, whether it's a C-section or a vaginal delivery, that is an injury to the tissue. The tissue is stretched. It can be torn. In a C-section, they're cutting all four. Yeah. And it's similar to ACL or, you know, ACL tear or spraining an ankle, but we just don't think about it in that way. And we're trying to start educating people that, you know, what you're feeling is a legitimate injury and it warrants proper care. And a lot of new moms don't get it because it's like, oh, you had a baby. What do you expect? That's kind of the dialogue that we currently have in the U.S.
Go back to work.
Yeah. And in France, they get 12 sessions regardless, paid for by the government with a pelvic physiotherapist after delivery. That is just the normative care in France, 12 visits.
Dang, kudos to France.
I know.
For real.
Yes. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, good news, guys. My 6-year-old is learning French right now in kindergarten. So I will be set to move to France in no time at all. So get on it, Jess. Learn me some French so you can take your mama around.
Yes, they don't like it when you don't speak French there.
Right.
I mean, arguably, Americans usually don't like it when you don't speak English either. Like, we're probably not a heck of a lot better, but yeah, I wouldn't be moving somewhere if I didn't know the language. Although, I really want to move to Japan, so another time. Another day, another story for another time, perhaps. We'll see. I'm too lazy. I'm going to stay put, I think. Yeah, Jess has got us covered, guys. Don't worry. Yes,
that's
I will definitely echo that childbirth is a lot, and I want to issue a public apology to my mom while I'm here right now. She never went into labor with me. They just decided to pluck me out and did a C-section. Whole nother story. But I was 11 pounds, 14 ounces. I was gargantuan. So, sorry, Mom. It was because she fed me exclusively Häagen-Dazs ice cream for the entire price. She swears up and down to this day. She said everything else made me puke. So I only ate Baskin Robbins and Häagen-Dazs ice cream. That was all she could do for the entire pregnancy. And she gained a lot of weight and carried my ass around for like a long, long time. Cause I was late to my own party. I was 3 weeks overdue, which is why finally they were like, she's never coming out. We just have to pluck her out. Gosh. Damn it. Come on. And yes, I was gigantic. So it's probably, I don't want to say it's just as well. Cause I've heard stories of women giving birth to like 13 pound babies vaginally. But a little piece of me does wonder, like, maybe they spared my mom some significant trauma doing the C-section.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And after that, this might segue into something else. Ever since I was born, my mom has said that she's had weak puckering strings. I don't know if you've heard that terminology, by the way. But that's, like, that's apparently what her mom and her mom said, and like that was like the phrase that the family used. But yes, she has weak puckering strings, and to this day, she will go sprinting to the bathroom because it's like when she realizes she has to go, it is automatically urgent. And I've been telling her for a couple of years, Mom, you really should do pelvic floor PT. Has she listened to her daughter? No. But I've tried to tell her about you guys, that you exist. But that is suggestive, I would imagine, of a pelvic floor that is hypotonic or weaker, right?
Yes, you got it. Absolutely. Urgency is generally accompanied with underactivity, not always, not 100% of the time, but generally associated. And all of that is super fixable. We can be working on building pelvic floor muscle strength and retraining the bladder. What often happens with urgency, it's like this slippery slope down the bladder trail where we have underactivity of the pelvic floor. She might have coughed or sneezed and experienced some stress urinary incontinence. And so she has been training herself to go to the bathroom just in case, or go to the bathroom at low volumes of bladder fullness, which in turn, interestingly enough, retrains the bladder to be highly sensitive. So if we think about the bladder, it can hold roughly 12 to 16 ounces of fluid. That's like, you know, think about your coffee drinks, the 12 to 16. That's quite a bit. That usually comes out unless you've been chugging it hard to every 2 hours or so. And generally speaking, we get these nice little urgency warnings that are not super intense or very stressful. Yep. And then we calmly proceed to a restroom. Yep. But what happens is if you start going to the bathroom just in case at these low volumes here, or going at only half volumes, your bladder sensors start to become highly sensitized to that. And they say, hey, Nicole's mom, I'm down here at 400 mils, and this is generally when you go to the bathroom, Nicole's mom, go to the bathroom. She's going to hate me. I'm so sorry, Nicole's mom.
You can use your name, Robin. It's fine. It's all good. I'll straight up tell her we talked about her today.
So we can send, the bladder can become very, very bossy and controlling, and it will give a very intense urgency message. You got to go now or I'm going to leak on you, which is very alarming. Yeah. It sends us into a fight or flight response, which is a totally different neurological experience. Mm-hmm. And boom, we go. So what we do with people is we're working on rebuilding pelvic floor muscle strength. And interestingly enough, the nerves in the pelvic floor also share nerve roots in the bladder muscles themselves. So when we strengthen here and when we contract these muscles, it actually forces a relaxation in the bladder muscles themselves. And so we work on that. And then we work on staying calm, working through the first urgency, building up tolerance again to get that bladder nice and full. calmly proceeding to the restroom. And that sounds all well and nice, but people have a great difficulty with it. So we do that in small increments. We call it bladder retraining. And it's all very functional, because when you think about getting in the car for a car ride or getting on an airplane or trying to attend a show or something, that bossy bladder can really get in the way of stuff. So it's worth it to go to pelvic PT. We're lovely people and we're here to help. So come on down.
You heard it here, Mom.
She needs to take care of that bossy bladder.
I know.
That's right. Don't
or as
let
she
that
calls
bladder.
It, weak puckering strings.
Yes, her weak puckering strings.
I have to say, 13 years in pelvic health, I thought I'd heard everything until today. That is brand spanking new to me.
Well, I'm going to give you another one. You ready for this?
Yes.
Okay, so a good friend of mine in grad school, when we were in chiropractic school together, one of his friends had just graduated medical school, I think. And he was doing, I think, a residency in the ER. And I feel like ER doctors have the best stories anyway, that are just horrifying. But there was a woman who came in, and I forget the exact genesis of like why she came into, I think it was the ER. And long story short, she had been having prolapse of her uterus, and it was actually starting to come out. So she decided to rectify that situation by putting, I kid you not, a potato in her vagina.
Oh,
and
sure.
And she left it up there. For a while, and the vagina is dark and moist, and you can imagine where I'm going with this. The potato sprouted
into her
vagina.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she had the sprouts growing all over the place, so that was a very peculiar day at the ER. So I don't know if you've heard something that funny, but...
I mean, I'm not, like... On a certain level, I'm not shocked. I mean, I'm interested that it was the choice was a potato and not a less porous or living thing. But
right.
I know that desperate times call for desperate measures. And, you know, that kind of thing is so embarrassing to people. You know, what we could do is give that person a pessary, which would be a device that would go up and hold that cervix back into place. And that is certainly something that we do. But I'm so sorry to hear that she chose a potato.
Well, and I think that probably speaks to the crappy medical system we have in the United States. Like, it's great in a lot of ways, but also there's a lot of people who can't afford medical care.
Absolutely.
And it was probably like, even if she thought, oh, the potato is not a good choice, if she was really strapped for cash, that might have been the only option. And then like, all right, let's just shove something up there and hope for the best. I can't have my uterus literally falling out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like that's a very clear failure of the American healthcare system.
Yes. And hats off to the creativity there. I mean, I can appreciate your line of thinking of like this, it'll fit. If it, if it goes, it goes.
Yep.
Well, and I was curious too. I know you had mentioned earlier how like squatty potty can be helpful, like certain positions when pooping can be helpful. I was curious. I know you said that sometimes the muscles can get really tight. If there are any like common exercise techniques or like things that people could do that almost like stretch out the pelvic floor or work it out in a way that's helpful, that I don't know, or like specific types of exercise like squatting or certain yoga poses. Like, are there anything in particular that you like more than others, whether for constipation or other kind of gut stuff?
Absolutely. I love that you asked that question. I have about 4 or 5 pelvic floor release exercises that are generally associated with yoga. They're kind of yoga pose type maneuvers. Mm-hmm. And what I always do is just show them to the patient and then have them pick their favorite, you know, because it feels different on every body and they have different coordination systems. So my favorites are Happy Baby. So they're laying on their back and then feet come up. You can either grab around the backs of the knees or grab into the foot. And then the knees just gently fall out to the side. And during that time, I'm having them work on breathing through their entire abdomen, focusing on learning how to expand through their rib cage, through the sides and through the front, and then just letting the pelvic floor be. It's not that we're trying to force it into one position or the other. It's just it's almost like a control alt delete, like a reset position. So Happy Baby is one that I offer up. And then the second one is Child's Pose, but I offer modifications. So Child's Pose, where you're kind of on your knees and you're curled up and then your arms are forward, but the knees are nice and wide. And then from that, my favorite modifications are to take a pillow. And the first modification is to put the pillow in the fold of the front of your hip and lean over the top of that. So it creates almost a supported C curvature through the pelvis and through the lumbar spine, which can create a nice opening around the anus. So if you can imagine just that it's just more of a doming sensation from the entire spine around to the tailbone, which is where the pelvic floor muscles attach. And then if arms overhead doesn't feel good, they can bring them back around to their sides. And again, just breathing. The other modification of child's pose using the pillow is instead of the front of the fold, in the back fold of the knee. So to where it's between their bottom and their heels, and boom, the pillow's there. And that's nice for people that have knee pain. It also creates a little bit more generic opening around the pelvic floor. Like you might feel just a release around the vaginal opening and around the urethra and around the rectum. That one's my personal favorite. And it's just, it feels a little less crunched than traditional child's pose. And then a deep caveman squat, generally with arms overhead. So hanging onto the kitchen counter and just dropping the pelvic floor down. People can do this in their office. If they have a door that closes, they can kind of hold onto the door knob and drop and release there. And again, breathing into their pelvic floor and into their rib cage there. So those are the most common ones that I use. And then from there, if they have tight hips, so keeping in mind that the hips have muscles that back up to the pelvic floor, they share a fascial plane. And so we can stretch the hips with positions like pigeon or figure four, where you've got one ankle over your knee and you're just gently pushing and opening. So we can do some indirect stretch or mobility on the pelvic floor by working with the hip too. So those are my favorites. Yeah.
Those are fun. I like child's pose.
I know, you saw me. I went like this because that's my favorite yoga pose, because it feels, it's the easiest because I feel like I'm not doing anything, but I am doing something, and that's good news for me because I'm lazy. So I like kind of curling up in a ball.
Yeah. I like corpse pose too. That's actually not doing anything.
Wait, what is that just literally laying on your back?
Yeah, you're like laying on your back. I think it's called Savasana too. It's like you're just laying on your back. I used to tell people that was my favorite yoga pose, and I would get weird looks. Like, okay.
Well, you should have just told them Savasana, and then it would have sounded really legit and yogish. And people would be like, wow, she's really into yoga, and really you're saying, I like to lay and do nothing.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's funny because I got a little bit into yoga for like 2 months, I swear to God, when I lived in Arizona, right before we moved. And I found this really great place. It was called Yoga Nirvana. And then like the slogan painted on the mural on the wall inside was Come As You Are. And I thought that was such a clever reference to the band Nirvana, in addition to like, you know, Nirvana. Anyway, I thought it was brilliant. So shout out to them in Tempe, Arizona. But when I was going, and I'm sorry, I just derailed myself on the Yoga Nirvana thing and the quote, and I've completely derailed what else I was going to tell you. Oh, I remember I always wanted to sign up for like the really intense classes. Like, I want to get a good sweat and a good workout. And I remember a friend of mine was like, oh, I have these, you know, like yoga nidra or like more like meditative yoga classes. You should come to my classes sometimes. And I remember thinking, no, I want to go to the ones where I get a workout. And in retrospect, I'm like, oh, girl, you probably needed the relaxing ones more than the workout ones in retrospect at that point in my life, especially. But, you know, hindsight and stuff.
The longer we know ourselves, the more we can do better, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
It's true. Truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's like yin yang is usually, like yin yang yoga is usually a little bit more relaxed. But I think that I used to be like, oh, power yoga. Like power yoga classes tends to be way more intense. Yeah. Versus like flow or, you know, restorative yoga type classes, I think generally would be better for me now.
Yeah, they would have been better for me back then too, but
nothing.
One of these days we'll have to have a yoga dedicated episode for that matter. But I love that different disciplines kind of borrow from that and can use those same kind of stretches and same kind of exercises to benefit the body in different ways.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious too, yoga was actually like some exercise and poses. I was going to ask about that before Amy beat me to the punch. But now I'm curious because I've seen these funky looking wands on your Instagram page. And I'm very curious how those fold into the mix. Yes.
Ooh.
Yeah. So Amy, I don't know if you got a chance to creep on her Instagram when I told you we were going to speak with her today, but what is their deal? Like, how do you use these? Are they more appropriate for somebody with the tight pelvic floor, the loose puckering strings, as we call them? somewhere in between all of the above. Tell me all the things about these wands.
Yes. So the wands, there are three of them. I'm holding the turquoise one here. That's our vibrating one. So I designed and created them to be able to allow people to reach trigger points and tender points and perform myofascial release within the pelvic floor. You can do that by way of the vaginal opening or the rectal opening. Both are appropriate in certain cases. Most people with the vagina will prefer that route over the rectum, but for people with really profound tailbone pain or people that don't have the vaginal opening, the rectal opening is a good way to go as well. But the wands are all three shaped like this. The curvatures allow for different functions of them. Our purple wand is our original wand. That's the first one I ever created. This one vibrates, so it's got 10 frequencies of vibration. Vibration has been shown to help improve blood flow, help reduce overall tone. So for people that have very, very high tone, it's really beneficial there. So it has different frequencies to allow people to toggle through and feel which one's best for them. And then the yellow one is hot and cold. So it can be put in the freezer and it can retain cold to act as a thermal modality within the pelvic floor, or it can be run under hot water and retain that warmth. I'm a warm person. I am not a cold person, but I have so many patients that it's just been life shattering to be able to have something cold after like a long day, and they're really wound up and they really respond well to that. So, but what these do is they either end can go in the rectum or the vagina. So there's not one correct end. They're both correct. This end here is a little bit more blunt. It's a little bit easier to reach some of the superficial trigger points and tender points in the pelvic floor, or the ones. So for example, you come here. So if this is the vaginal, it can reach up and under. This particular curvature is very unique. It allows people to reach tender points that are right under the bladder here, which is very hard to release. And then the longer thin end allows for reaching the deeper pelvic floor, and then tricky little muscles like obturator internus. That's a fancy, fun term here for the muscles that come all the way out to the side. Mm. These muscles, if they are tight or have a tender point, can often masquerade or feel like hip pain or like groin pain sometimes, or deep glute pain. You can't reach it. You can't stretch it. You've been doing pigeon till the cows come home. Nothing's happening. Oftentimes it can be due to deep trigger points there. So this can come in and reach to the sidewalls of the pelvic floor like this and down and around. So that is what the wand is for.
Cool.
Yeah, I have never seen anything like that until I started following you on Instagram. And I was very curious. And I'm curious, like, what people or what symptoms would be best suited for each type of wand. So you said like the vibration can help release that hypertonicity. So people with really tight pelvic floors maybe would do better with the vibration, or maybe the heat as well.
Yeah. It usually comes down to individual preference as to what sounds good. That sounds so like easy and nebulous, but it's like what sounds good to you is often going to be what you attribute to healing, you know? So if you're like, oh my gosh, I love those, you know, vibrating chairs that rub the knots out of my back. That sounds good. Vibration is going to be for you. Or if you are a person with chronic inflammation in endometriosis, interstitial cystitis, some of those more inflammatory processes where you're like, oh my goodness, an ice pack inside my vagina sounds amazing, you know, or I've done cold packs and that really helps. That helps me get through the day. So your past prior experiences as a person as to what's helped modulate your symptoms. And then also, so the wands are for people that have pain in general. So people with very, very high tone that have responded well to manual therapy in the past or to vibrational therapies are going to do great with this. And I would say, generally speaking, this is a hit for most people, regardless of their inclination types, because it can be used in the off position. And then it can, of course, be used on.
Yeah, with vibration.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And I imagine, too, like to go back to what you're talking about with cold, and that's a great point. Women with endometriosis or like interstitial cystitis, I wonder too, like prostate issues, particularly prostatitis, might also really benefit from the cold wand, right? Because that's another
thing that
would be really inflamed and irritated and aggravated.
Yeah, the feedback we've got from people with prostatitis is that either the hot cold wand or the vibrational wand, and for them, they are definitely using this long, thin end here. So when we're thinking about So again, this is a female model, but for men, that prostate is going to be very closely located right underneath the urethra at the bottom of the pelvic bowl there. So they would go into the rectum and then loop forward. And this curvature allows them to be able to do that. Yeah.
In an effort to overshare again on the IBS Freedom podcast, I will share. So I have been moderately constipated since having my daughter. And I do this for a living. I do this for a damn living. I have done umpteen stool tests on myself. I have tested myself for SIBO. I've tried different prokinetics. I've tried different probiotics. I've tried different prebiotics. I'm stumped. And it's driving me nuts. And I thought for a while, too, I was like, well, maybe it's just stress. Because having kids can be stressful. I have a very strong-willed, opinionated child, for one. But also, like, I opened this practice the same year I had my daughter. So I opened up my practice in May, and then I had my daughter in September of the same year. Because that seemed like a good, solid idea.
Great, yeah.
And I went back to work immediately. I took, like, 1 week off of work and then went right back to work. And I was, like, pumping all the time. It was nuts. But I've had different theories over the years. But I thought, oh, maybe it was just stress. Maybe I'm just, like, a stress case now. But now I'm studying herbal medicine more and more, and I'm getting more familiar with herbs that would help with the stress response, and I've tinkered with a whole bunch of them. And I don't know even how much I've shared this with Amy, but like I've tinkered with a lot of adaptogens and nervines, and nothing's quite licking it. And I'm like, all right, damn it. If it's really the stress doing it, then one of these herbs should move the needle the right direction. And I've been gradually kind of working on exploring how my body handles stress and being more kind and gentle and understanding with myself. I'm doing the things, damn it. And nothing's moving the needle. And I've had a theory for a little while that maybe pelvic floor dysfunction is a piece of this. And I haven't wrapped my head around it fully. But what's interesting is, I'll just share, I actually did 2 sessions with a pelvic floor PT at some point earlier this year. And just for whatever reason, that individual, I was quite underwhelmed by that particular practitioner. And basically it was like, I went in, and she was like, okay, you should do yoga, you should do child's pose. But she didn't really demo it for me, and she didn't watch me do the poses either. So I got no feedback. It wasn't like how I imagined physical therapy of like, here's the exercise you do, now you do it. No, this is what you do, you know, this is what you're doing right, this is what you're doing wrong, kind of like coaching. So I backed it after 2 sessions because I was like, well, I need to find somebody else. I'm not bagging the profession, but I thought, no, I need to find somebody else who's going to suit my needs better. And I hadn't got around to it. So this is very, very interesting to me because honestly, I think I'm going to hop on your website and get one of those wands and see if maybe there's some, you know, trigger points essentially that I can work on with my own pelvic floor and then incorporate a couple of these exercises too. Very apropos.
Absolutely. Yes. And I everything that you just said is just so poignant because, you know, after childbirth, whether it's scarring in the perineum or different holding patterns associated with pain or some of the instability after having been pregnant for 9 months can lead to some of that coordination issues. It can also be that there's some clenching happening around that tailbone as well that doesn't necessarily match the front. So that highlights the importance of a really thorough and proper evaluation, not to speak ill of what happened or didn't happen, but you know, what you would want to expect in pelvic floor PT is like a really thorough, approximately 1 hour evaluation where you're talking about your medical history. They're assessing, actually manually assessing the pelvic floor muscles, and you come out of it with a newer understanding of the behavior of the pelvic floor. And then, like you said, like one-on-one guidance and support. And, you know, it's like with dentists, like there's some dentists that are great educators and there are some that it's just not like the right match, or you don't feel like you have like a proper understanding, and that happens in all the different professions. So
ours super too, for sure.
Yeah mm-hmm. It's like in different personalities, you know, some people need a very calm provider, some people need somebody with like a little bit more personality and spunk to them. So there's so many out there. I can definitely help connect you with somebody in your area. Part of our services at Intuit Rose is we always help connect people with other pelvic PTs, some of which I know personally and some of which are just part of our database. So in that case, you know, we want to give you three or four names just in case it's not a match. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I will say too, I don't know if the office had this because it was a private practice with a handful of pelvic floor PTs. I forget how many, like three or four, maybe approximately, maybe five. But I don't know if they had biofeedback and she just hadn't done it with me yet. Because again, I kind of bagged it after two. But I was also thinking, or initially, oh, maybe I need to find somebody who could do like biofeedback and help me. Because I am typically a very visual learner. I'm pretty good with auditory also. Like I could hear a lecture and remember a lot of it after the fact, which is great. But like any of my patients would tell you, like I'm drawing stuff, usually in Microsoft Paint, on my computer, like showing them doodles or I'm hand drawing something. So I think having the visual of either biofeedback or the ultrasound, like you were describing, would be really helpful. And then, yeah, I think I would also want like some degree of autonomy and like understanding to move forward. So yeah, that would be awesome. If you have any names in my area, I'll reach back out to you after the fact.
Yeah.
Cause yeah, like I said, I've had in the back of my head for a few months, okay, I need to find a new name. I need to find a new person. But I hadn't gotten around to it yet. I kept putting it on the back burner. And now here we are. And I think it's high time.
It's time.
I was curious too, because I don't know if now would be a good time to talk about how we originally were talking about constipation, mm-hmm. but how pelvic floor PT helps with things like diarrhea or like bloating and some of the other symptoms of gut dysfunction.
Pain, like abdominal pain.
Yeah, like, could you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So with respect to the fact that there could be a number of factors contributing to mm-hmm. the outcome of diarrhea and inflammatory type symptoms, in pelvic physical therapy, we would be taking a complete medical history. If we're recognizing symptoms that we suspect SIBO or some of the other like nutritional aspects, we would certainly want to be getting a great dietitian on board or a functional medical practitioner like yourself so that we're all working together to address, you know, the overall person in front of us. And then in our actual scope, in our actual physical therapy, we would be working on a lot of techniques to be providing some neural calming. And so what we would be doing is looking at the activities of daily living, the stress cycles of that person and how it relates to their toileting. Generally, we would be recommending some body scanning techniques to where this person would have an organized and systematic way of at least daily going through and identifying areas of their body that are experiencing clenching or overactivity so that we can be reducing the musculoskeletal stress load. And then we would be doing manual therapy on any areas that are restricted that could be contributing to breath holding or bracing of the abdomen, which can sometimes result in that inflammatory belly type, bloated types symptoms where, you know, they might be kind of a bracer, for example, if they're somebody who's conscious about their weight or their body and they walk around clenching their abdominals all day, like sucking it in, that can put a lot of compression on the intestines and result in really a number of different toileting behaviors. But we would be addressing that with them. We would be looking at possible pain drivers and then certainly working closely with gastroenterology as to if there's, you know, something more serious such as celiac or, you know, inflammatory bowel disease process on board if we were not getting suspected outcomes from our clinical treatment or if they came in with that already, we would just mm-hmm. be addressing that.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up like the bracing. I don't know. I just my husband's side of the family, like when they're taking a picture, you know, it's like him, his dad, and his sister all like, it's like, oh no, guys, like, you're fine. You're all beautiful. You have beautiful bodies. You don't need to be sucking in every picture we take. But I think again, like, until like I hung around them all the time, I like didn't think people were doing that regularly. But I think again, it's more common than I realized, you know, people that are self-conscious and kind of sucking in or bracing, what you were saying, breathing wise. So that's interesting. I had never thought about that, like from a gut function standpoint, but I'm sure it does affect gut function in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, just compressing it in.
I'll have to yell at them the next time they all do it. You're ruining your gut function and your pelvic floor. everything's messed up when you're sucking in for this picture. I hope it's worth it.
You give a 1-4, Amy.
Right.
Oh, goodness. Well, and if you think about it, that kind of would send you into fight or flight a bit too, right? Can you imagine, like, sucking it in and holding your breath a bit? Like, pretty quickly, your heart rate's going to go up, your blood pressure's going to go up, you're going to be in that. It's almost like your body probably interprets that as, like, okay, we're bracing, something bad's going to happen, somebody's going to punch me in the gut, somebody's going to knock me over. Got a brace for that, so I can imagine that being a fight or flight cue.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
One other question, too. One thing I've seen a decent amount of is, like, diastasis recti. Did I pronounce that right?
Potato.
Okay. Is that something that you work on heavily with, like, your clients? And I'd just be curious, like, what some of the plan is for someone like that has the diastasis. Explain what it is, and then tell us a little bit more about how you can help.
Yeah, absolutely. Diastasis recti, or diastasis rectus abdominis, DRA.
That's probably best.
It's easier. It's a condition where, so if you think about the pretty six-pack muscles in the front of the abdomen, those are the first layer of four layers of abdominal muscles, but those muscles can separate in pregnancy. So when I say can, I mean 100% of people in their third trimester are going to experience separation of those muscles. And they can go back to their original alignment in varying degrees. Typically, when we're talking about DRA, we're talking about somebody who has noticed on themselves, or a healthcare provider has noticed that there's a gap. So we've got these nice little columns that have attachment with a nice strong that is stretched or torn, as with pregnancy, or sometimes just it can happen in people that have different functional movements when they're lifting heavy things and they're not using their core properly. But most often we attribute it with pregnancy because of the stretching nature. So generally those muscles will come back together in an alignment that closely resembles what it was prior, but sometimes it doesn't. And that can be often attributed to actual injury of that fascial material, where it's torn or stretched to the point where it's not going back. So in pelvic physical therapy, when we think about those abdominals being a really crucial member of the stabilizer of the spine, we want to be thinking about retraining the mechanics of the muscles underneath it. So the muscles in the front, the pretty ones with the separation happens, are not the biggest team player in core stability. It's actually the muscles underneath it, but we still want to have good connection all the way around. It's oftentimes not the flaming, fiery emergency that people think it is. It can be highly alarming to look down and see a gap, and there's a lot of really kind of negative connotations and imagery. Sometimes I see some fitness professionals making a bigger deal of it than it needs to be. Because a lot of times small levels of that separation is super functional. It's the person is still having good coordination of the muscles underneath, and it is what it is. And, they've got good closure when they do functional activities, but sometimes it needs to be retrained. We can provide some taping to those abdominals while we're working on training. What that does mostly is cue the brain. Interestingly enough, it's not that we're taping you back together and that's how you're going to live. It's mostly that we're re-cueing your brain as to what the borders of those muscles feel like. And also we're training the muscles underneath it to help stabilize that. And then we're giving gentle exercises to progressively strengthen the deeper abdominal muscles. In the cases where it's wider than three fingers, oftentimes that does need to be repaired. And so then we would be looking for a very highly skilled surgical professional to come in and intervene, because that width of three fingers can actually be dangerous, because the abdominal organs are not receiving the protection that they need from those muscles. And so then we would be looking for a more a more surgical approach to it versus the conservative approach of exercise. But just want to highlight that it happens in varying degrees. It can be fixable. There is specific exercises that can help provide that closure, and people can still run and do planks and do fun exercises even with DRA as long as they're doing it safely and with a good coordination of the muscles underneath it.
I'm glad you bring that up because I feel like some of the people I've talked to, it seems urgent. Like what you're saying, there's like an urgency of like, and I have this issue. And it's like, and I'm glad you're sort of putting a context around it where like, oh, there's definitely things you can do. And for some people, it might be more of an issue than others. Because again, I've definitely seen varying degrees of urgency with my clients who have that as well.
Sure. Well, and from an aesthetic standpoint, you know, sometimes they think that they have a pooch and it looks bad and they want to go back to the way they were, or they, you know, they've seen so much alarming content on the internet, right, that it causes them a lot of fear. Like, my spine's unstable, my abdomen's unstable, I'm going to break. What's happening to me? So it's calmly make an appointment.
Yeah.
You will be okay.
Lord knows the internet is riddled with falsehoods. Not on the IBS Freedom podcast, mind you. We are 100% right all the time. But rest of the internet, yikes, is all I have to say. Especially, heaven forbid, if you go on one of those Facebook groups for whatever disease or condition or symptom you have. Oh my God. You will think that you are doomed for sure in very short order.
Yeah, for sure.
I think probably 50% of my Instagram reels are picking on those Facebook groups in some way, shape, or form, if I had to wager a bet. I'll have to go through and look at my data down the road, but I think I pick on them quite a lot.
As you should.
That's right. Well, all right, guys. I feel like I don't think I have any more questions, unless, Amanda, if you have anything else that you want to share or something. I mean, I already shared the potato story, and that was really the number one in my mind that I needed to share with you. but I can't think of other questions necessarily. I am a little bit curious, though, if I might put you on the spot a bit. You had said that you had some gut problems yourself, right? You know, this will kind of be like the icing on the cake of a really nice podcast episode, but I'm kind of curious what the nature of that was and like what ultimately you did to correct the issue, assuming that you no longer have gut issues now today.
Yeah, so I have celiac disease, and I have seemingly a genetic form. So I have two little boys that are 5 and almost 8, and they also have it. I was the kiddo that I was very active and very, very productive. It never really got in my way, but always had a tummy ache, always had, you know, diarrhea and just a lot of gut stuff. Certainly had a pretty stressful childhood too, but so I was diagnosed with celiac while I was in the doctorate program, but it took me 4 gastroenterologists, and this was, I want to say, 14 years ago before celiac was being really recognized. I'm so thankful that I was in Denver, Colorado at the time, that had just some really forward-thinking, awesome gastroenterologists, but I want to share that, you know, I was in PT school, and the first gastroenterologist like saw me, and he, you know, did this very patronizing, "Well, yeah, you have IBS. You're a student in a doctorate program. What do you expect? You're under a lot of stress. You don't have any money." Like, literally, he said that to me.
Oh my gosh!
And so, like, took a couple more. Finally, found somebody who was able to recognize some of the symptoms and attributed them to celiac. I had a lot of different, you know, imaging and scopes and different procedures, but finally landed on the diagnosis. I would say over the last 14 years, like, my food sensitivities have grown. I have many food sensitivities. I find, like, I'm pretty handy in the kitchen. I enjoy cooking. I make everything from scratch. But one of the things that you wrote in your email to me, Nicole, actually just totally resonated. I think I hadn't really merged myself with the people that I see. You know, it's very hard to be objective about ourselves.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
But certainly in my patients, I have a deep sympathy for and grace with people that have these gut issues. They're miserable. They don't feel well. And so they get very restrictive and, you know, they go on the FODMAP and then, you know, the gluten's gone and then the dairy's gone and the soy is gone and the corn is gone and then the food is gone.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just really interesting when there was just something about the wording in your email where I was like, oops, yeah, I think that I have fallen into that category where I have this clinical diagnosis. I do have a lot of sensitivities and it's never been intentional on my part, but I think that some of the times you're just so desperate to feel better that you start eliminating massive food groups and you're still not feeling better. And then you have to take a good hard look at the stress. And I, you know, I definitely do that and use mind body exercise and whatnot. But it's just almost this accidental slide into highly restrictive food eating. And it, I think for me, I've never even shared this, but I think for me, it was almost like if I behave, if I'm just so good and eat so clean, maybe that will be the ticket to feeling better. Yep. You know, it's like, if I'm just good, like every day, all day, can I just feel better? So it's just one of those really hard things. And, you know, the sensitivities are real. The allergies are real. But if you have to manage the stress too, because at the end of the day, you know, if you're eating clean foods, there's going to be something to provide that nutrition. Managing the other things is going to help calm down that neural system so you're not always in that foul state.
Well, and it's funny that you talk about sensitivities in particular, because like I don't know how much I shared now. I don't think I shared much of it in the email, but in our very first episode, Amy and I talked a lot about our histories. So I'm a celiac too. And I definitely had IBS. I think I had SIBO looking back at my symptoms because I was also chopping things off the chopping block. I did AIP before it was called AIP. So I was cutting out all the grains, all the legumes, all the lectins, the soy, the corn, the eggs, the dairy, the whatever. And I was hacking out these big food groups of food until I was left with literally fruits, vegetables, meat. And that's pretty much it. And it was band-aiding my symptoms, but I still had to get to the root of like the dysbiosis. Mm. What I look back now and I realize was probably SIBO. And for me, I learned I had not one, but two parasites. Surprise. So I treated the dysbiosis that I had, and then that led to more resolution in some of these other food sensitivities. And then for Amy, she was diagnosed with SIBO. And I mean, you could speak to, I don't want to like tell your own story, Amy.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I had SIBO, and I think both Nikki and I have both been in the situation where it's like the knee-jerk reaction, I think, for everyone that's dealing with gut issues is like, well, I can manage this with food. Like, as long as I can figure out what diet to follow, what to eliminate, what to eat, I will be able to manage. Right. I'll be able to manage all the symptoms. But I think that that usually comes at a cost of nutrition. So it's like this fine balance of, yes, you want to eliminate the foods that you're sensitive to, but you also want to dig deeper as to, okay, what you were describing, is it the stress? How much is the stress playing into some of the reactions compared to the food? Or how much is sleep playing into the mix or movement? Or like, there's so many different things that could cause reactions. And again, even to Nikki's point, like, what's your microbiome look like? Or do you have a higher need for certain pancreatic enzymes? Or like, you know, what, or you need motility support or something like that. So I think it's oversimplified, unfortunately. So much of it is in the like SIBO IBS space where it's cutting out all these foods and hoping for the best. And we've all been there, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
So we've all been a part of that. And I think, again, like what I've learned through it is the more I could kind of dig a little bit deeper, like what you were describing, looking at kind of other factors. And I'll try to get my clients to do that too, where it's like, okay, if you do have a symptom and it's something that's becoming consistent, try to don't just look at the food that you're eating. You could view that as a factor maybe, but like look at, okay, was I more stressed that day? Did I sleep well the night before? Did I eat at a different time than usual? Like,
Where was I in my menstrual cycle?
Right. I think again, the core of it is I think it oversimplifies a more complex situation a lot of times, but yeah, you're definitely not alone in feeling sort of like desperate at eliminating foods in hopes that the issues get better. Because, again, we've all been there, and a lot of our clients have been there, too. And it sounds like you see it with your patients.
Absolutely.
And it is, it's almost, in a way, related back to what you were talking about earlier, going back to the weak puckering strings and how that person might, I'm going to keep going back to these two things. Weak puckering strings and potatoes, people, those are the themes. That should be the name of this episode. Should we really confuse our listeners? No. We can call it Puckering Strings and Potatoes with Amanda Olson. Oh my God, how funny would that be? No, we should probably name it more appropriately than that, but that'll be the subtitle underneath the main title. How about that?
Yeah, parentheses.
But it kind of goes back to, like, the initial problem with that scenario, like my mom's case, was probably low pelvic floor tone or dysfunction or discoordination. And then by nature of her, like, maybe having an accident or being afraid of having an accident, and then she starts kind of band-aiding it by emptying the bladder when it's only half full, then it's like reinforcing the problem in a way, because then the bladder starts getting those signals out when the bladder's only half full. And then now you have this diminished capacity for the bladder. It's almost similar in a weird way, because like I found with me, I did feel notably better when I cut out gluten. I mean, shock, right? Yeah. But for me, gluten and dairy and sesame were the big three for me in the beginning, where I was like, whoa, my body doesn't like these. Holy moly. And then that kind of reinforced the idea of food is the problem. So it's like every time you cut out a food and you feel a little bit better, even if it's kind of a temporary band-aid, your brain is interpreting that as, see, the food's the problem. And therefore, there must be another problem food that I can find. And it's something elusive, like mustard. It's the damn mustard. And then, like, you cut out the mustard and you feel a smidge better. And you're like, oh, man, I knew it was the food. And then it kind of entrenches you further in that dysfunction, right?
Totally. That is, like, 100% it. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
We've cracked so many things today.
Yes. Packed a lot in. And we could continue the conversation a little bit more, you know, after the recording is done, perhaps, because I had some other ideas to share, too. Like, for example, being a fellow celiac and having at least one autoimmune disease, right? There's also some likelihood that your immune system is a bit wackadoo. And I say that with love. So maybe some immune balancing or immune kind of supportive work could be in the cards as well. Certainly microbiome stuff would be in the cards with a history of celiac disease. So we could kind of help you a little bit more when we're off air. But I think this is probably a good point to wrap up pelvic floor conversation in and of itself. But yeah, just thank you so much for coming on. This was such a good episode, and I really think that this will help a lot of our listeners. Remind me, so it's Intimate Rose is your Instagram handle. Is your website URL the same, I believe? IntimateRose.com?
Yes, IntimateRose.com. And on there I have hundreds of different videos and blog articles and guides. Basically a guide for every different type of pelvic floor dysfunction. All of the devices, there are other devices besides the wand, but all the devices have their own guides as well. So we have that and a really great support team. I answer questions that people have. Like I mentioned, we help connect people with other pelvic health practitioners in their area. So we try to
on that offer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I just can't thank you enough for saying yes when I invited you on the pod, because I had been creeping on you for a while and I thought you looked like a good person to talk to, and I was correct. This was a really awesome episode. So thank you. And I'll definitely keep in touch and keep following your work on Instagram. So officially
a fan. Thank you for having me. Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, that's a wrap. Everybody, you know the drill, but I'm going to tell you anyway. This is what, episode 67 or something at this rate, but I'll still say it again. If you would feel so inclined to review this podcast or give us a thumbs up or give us a subscribe on YouTube, that would actually help us grow this podcast and reach more people. So 5-star reviews on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever it's called these days, would be great. Or a like or subscribe or a comment on YouTube. Sometimes Amy and I do Q&As on Instagram, so make sure you keep those. We started talking about this and then, like, we stopped doing them for a while. We're recording this around the holidays. Like, I don't know. We'll resume it in 2022, I think. But in theory, Amy and I do Q&As, and we post awesome content on Instagram as well. So I'm at Triangle Guts, that's Guts plural with an S, and Amy is at Amy_HollandCamp_RD. So give our three Instagrams a follow if you want to learn more rad stuff, and we will see you right back here on the IBS Freedom Podcast. Thanks so much.